Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take your pile of information and turn it into actionable insight. I'm Joe Cunningham, your guide for today.
And I'm Lee Meacham, ready to help connect the dots and explore what truly matters in the stories we uncover.
Today, we're embarking on a truly comprehensive deep dive into Newsweek USA for the week of September 5th to 12th, 2025.
That's right.
We've got a stack of articles, features, insights, you name it, from this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And our mission really is to extract every important nugget of knowledge, talk about the implications, and make sure you walk away feeling, well, thoroughly informed.
And maybe a little surprised by some of the connections we find, right?
Exactly.
Because this issue, it's real mosaic. We're talking global sports business, health insights, geopolitical analysis.
Culture, innovation, it covers a lot of ground.
It really does. So we're going to break each piece down, not just what happened, but, why does it matter? Why should you care?
Okay, so settle in. We're about to unpack some really compelling stories. Let's get started. All right, let's kick things off with a big one right there on the cover. The Kansas City Chiefs.
Yep.
And their CEO, Clark Hunt. The article is called Empire of the Sun.
Mm.
And it digs into how he steered that franchise to, well, NFL supremacy. 3 Super Bowl wins in 5 seasons. That's something else.
It really is. But the article makes it clear it's not just about winning on the field.
Right. There's this whole global ambition piece.
Exactly. And what's really fascinating, I think, is how it connects back to his father, Lamar Hunt.
Lamar Hunt, the founder.
Right. And apparently Lamar had this vision way back in the 1970s.
The 70s. Wow.
Yeah. He saw international markets as the NFL's future growth engine. Decades ago. He was way ahead of his time.
So this isn't some recent bandwagon thing for the Chiefs?
Not at all. For the Hunts, it's a legacy project.
Yeah.
Clark Hunt and the team president, Mark Donovan, they were focused on getting the franchise ready even when the team wasn't, winning Super Bowl.
Setting the stage.
Precisely. Their goal was, and they said this, to capture that moment when success finally hit. Make sure the brand was ready for the spotlight.
And clearly it worked.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. The Chiefs are now the number one NFL brand in the U.S., which is huge. But get this.
Uh-huh.
They're also number one in 6 out of 9 international markets they track.
6? Which ones?
Germany, the U.K., Australia, Brazil, France, and Spain.
That's genuinely global dominance.
It is. And they're number 2 in Canada and Ireland, 3rd in Mexico. It's a massive footprint.
Okay, so that kind of success, both on the field and in global branding, it doesn't happen by accident. The NFL itself has been pushing internationally, too.
Oh, definitely. The league started opening up these international marketing rights about, 10 years ago?
Mm.
Teams could bid for specific countries.
And the Chiefs jumped in.
Aggressively.
Yeah.
They initially got Germany and Mexico, then they strategically added the UK and Spain.
So it's more than just playing a game there once in a while.
Much more. It involves, constant grassroots marketing all year round in those places, building the fan base from the ground up.
And then bringing the actual games.
Exactly, like they've done in Frankfurt, Mexico City, London. And this year, a really big one is coming up September 5th in São Paulo, Brazil.
Against the Chargers.
Right. And the interesting thing there, it's being streamed entirely free on YouTube.
Oh, that's smart. Huge potential audience.
Massive accessibility. And, the players feel it, too. Patrick Mahomes mentioned the fans in Frankfurt.
Yeah.
So the passion was overwhelming, claimed 80% of the crowd were Chiefs fans.
80% in Germany.
Yeah. And you have to remember, the NFL has history here. They played preseason games years ago in Japan, Mexico, even Berlin, right when the wall came down.
Ah, so they laid some groundwork.
They did. Those early games proved there was an appetite for American football outside North America.
So it sounds like a balancing act, though, expanding globally while keeping the home fans happy.
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
How do they manage that? And, has anything unexpected helped this global surge?
Well, on the engagement front, they've shifted. It's not just about game day anymore. It's continuous interaction. Social media, behind-the-scenes stuff.
Like that ESPN series, The Kingdom.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That gave fans an inside look, made them feel connected year-round, even during the off-season push for 3 straight Super Bowls. It builds loyalty.
Okay, but the unexpected part.
Right. The Taylor Swift effect.
Ah, yes. The Kelce connection.
You can't ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
Her relationship with Travis Kelce has brought this huge, totally new demographic to the Chiefs.
Young female fans, primarily.
Significantly so. Clark Hunt himself noted it. He thinks it might push the Chiefs' female fan base over 50%.
Over half. That's a massive shift.
It really is. And it's not just like a happy accident they're ignoring. They're actively targeting this demographic.
How so?
They have things like an annual style lounge.
Yeah.
Showcasing fashion, how it intersects with the NFL. It's smart.
Tapping into that cultural moment?
Precisely. And the NFL's VP of Global Brand Marketing, Sarah Bishop, confirms it. The NFL is now the number one U.S. sport for women.
Really?
Yeah, she says over 65% of American women are driving that growth. It shows the league's reach is moving way beyond traditional sports fans. Pop culture is a powerful force.
Okay, the Chiefs are clearly a major case study here. But what about the bigger picture, that other article touching down worldwide?
Yeah.
What does it say about the NFL's overall global strategy?
Right, that piece broadens the lens, and the numbers are pretty staggering.
Like what?
The NFL now claims 183 million fans globally. That's just in the 9 markets they measure.
183 million. Wow.
Outside the U.S., Mexico's the biggest market, nearly 40 million fans. Brazil's right behind with 36 million.
And media reach.
Over 195 countries and territories.
Oh, wait,
more than 80 media partners. Content in over 25 languages. It's vast.
What's driving that growth besides marketing?
International players are a huge factor. There were over 85 foreign-born players in the league in 2024.
And they have programs to find more, don't they?
Yes, several key initiatives. There's a designated 17th spot on every team's practice squad just for international talent.
Ah, like Jordan Mailata for the Eagles, the former rugby player.
Exactly. He's a perfect example. Came through that pathway. Now he's a starting left tackle for a team that won a Super Bowl. It shows you can find elite athletes anywhere.
So they're not just looking for ready-made players. They're developing talent, too.
For sure. They have NFL OFLAG, which is their youth flag football program. It's in 15 international markets now.
And that helps bring in more girls and women, too, right?
That's a key goal, yes. Then there are the NFL academies.
What are those?
They're basically elite football and education programs for high school-age kids. One in the UK, for Europe and Africa. One in Australia for Asia Pacific.
And are they producing results?
Seems like it. The article says 27 Academy alumni are committed to play NCAA Division I college football this year. That's a real pathway.
And the International Player Pathway Program, the IPP?
Right, that started in 2017. They actively scout young athletes globally, even if they haven't played football before. Bring them to the U.S. for training, showcase them for scouts.
So it's multi-layered. Scouting, development.
And the international games themselves. 7 this year in 5 different markets.
Including new places like São Paulo, Dublin, Madrid.
Yep, alongside London and Berlin. Mm-hmm. And the choice of cities isn't random.
It's data-driven.
Highly. They look at existing fan numbers, how successful watch parties have been, community engagement, all that stuff.
And they treat these games seriously.
Internally, they call each one a mini Super Bowl. Huge effort, huge investment.
Beyond the games, what else?
Merchandise, obviously.
Yeah.
Video games like Madden are massive tools.
We're reaching younger fans.
Yeah, and even integrations into platforms like Fortnite and Roblox. Widening the funnel, attracting casual fans, building that base.
It sounds incredibly comprehensive. No wonder someone like Mikel Tafoya was surprised.
Right, the former sideline reporter. She mentioned being surprised at the global appeal, given how dominant soccer is in Europe. But she acknowledged the NFL's power.
So, with all this travel, these international games, it must be tough on the teams logistically.
It definitely presents challenges. Time zones, long flights.
How do they handle it? Andy Reid, for instance.
His strategy, according to the piece, is all about consistency. Trying to make it feel as much like a normal road trip as possible, despite the distance.
Structured schedules, familiar routines.
Exactly. Structured hotels, set meeting times. Minimizing disruption. It's meticulous.
So the big takeaway here is the NFL isn't just expanding. It's really redefining what a global sports league can be.
I think that's fair to say. It's this multi-pronged approach in marketing, player development, strategic partnerships, even leveraging pop culture moments. It feels quite unprecedented, doesn't it?
It really does. Turning an American passion into a truly global phenomenon. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. From the global ambitions of the NFL, we turn to another sports icon, but in a very different arena, Terry Bradshaw.
The quarterback himself.
But not on the field. In the kitchen.
Chuckles. Yeah, that's quite a pivot, isn't it?
His article, Full Plate, reveals he's now a cookbook author.
It really shows you the diverse interests people have, doesn't it? Especially public figures.
Definitely. Bradshaw's got Super Bowl rings, Emmys, he's acted, done music, has his own bourbon.
And peanut butter. Don't forget the peanut butter.
Right. And now, a cookbook. Was this his idea?
Apparently not originally. Others suggested it. But what's kind of charming is how he turned it into a family project.
Involving his wife and daughters.
And his son-in-law, who's a chef. It was a real collaboration.
That's nice.
There's a funny story in there, too, about the money side.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently, his family didn't realize there was, like, a financial deal involved. When he told them they got a check, and his youngest daughter and son-in-law missed out because they hadn't participated.
Let me guess, Bradshaw was thrilled.
He couldn't wait to get off the phone and laugh. It shows that competitive streak. And his humor.
Classic Bradshaw. So, for a guy with such a varied career, what's his personal go-to food? Anything surprising?
Surprisingly simple, actually. Basic ice cream.
Ice cream.
Strawberry, vanilla, chocolate. He calls himself old school.
Huh. But the article suggests there's more depth to his thoughts on food.
Oh, absolutely. He gets quite reflective about how food and family time have changed.
Lamenting fast food.
Yeah, he says, for the most part, it has not been a good thing for American society. He really cherishes memories of family meals cooking together.
Like at his grandmother's house.
Exactly. Everyone piling in on weekends, food being central. He calls them heavenly times. There's a sense he feels we've lost some of that connection, that tradition.
Amidst his very modern, diverse career. Interesting contrast.
It is.
And I hear there's a legendary Bradshaw recipe in the book.
Yes. The legendary Bradshaw beans.
Legendary. Tell me more.
It's more than just a recipe. It's got a story. Inspired by his brother, he perfected it. Uses black, red, and white beans.
Okay.
But the key, he insists, is mixing them by hand.
By hand?
Yeah, like really getting in there. Mm-hmm. Apparently, he famously lost his wedding ring doing it once.
No way. In the beans.
Chuckles in the beans. They cook it traditionally over an open pit for hours or in the oven. It's a real slow-cooked, big-batch kind of dish. Tailgating food.
Sounds hearty. And there's a barbecue sauce, too?
Bradshaw. Bourbon barbecue sauce, developed by his son-in-law, Noah Hester.
Using his bourbon, I assume?
Naturally. It blends those caramel and vanilla notes from the bourbon with brown sugar, cinnamon. Sounds pretty versatile. They use it on wings and in the beans, of course.
So for Terry, food is clearly tied to family, memory, shared experiences.
Absolutely. It's a tangible link to his roots, even with all the other things he does.
A real journey of flavor and tradition. Okay, speaking of journeys, the magazine also takes us on some quintessential journeys across Turkey.
Yes. A shift from the personal kitchen to a whole country.
And this isn't just your standard travel guide, is it? It feels more like an invitation to a deep dive into culture and history.
I agree. What's insightful about Turkey's approach, as shown here, is how they managed to blend the ancient with the hypermodern. It's almost like a strategy.
Appealing to different travelers at once.
Exactly. You've got luxurious cruises on traditional boats, but also these mind-blowing archaeological sites like Göbekli Tepe that are literally rewriting human history.
Göbekli Tepe, I've heard of that. Incredibly old.
Unbelievably. Predates Stonehenge, the pyramids, by millennia. But we'll get to that. The point is, Turkey makes ancient history feel as relevant and exciting as a modern city break. It offers huge value, diverse experiences.
So let's start where many do, Istanbul, the bridge between continents.
Right. Napoleon supposedly called it the capital if the world were only one country. And it really does feel like this unique blend of Europe and Asia.
How do you experience that blend?
Well, you can literally retrace the steps of the Orient Express. There's a restored version running again. Or just arrive via Europe's train network at Sirkeci Station.
Or by sea.
Yeah, the new Galataport terminal is apparently quite grand. And it leads you right to Istanbul Modern, a top-tier art museum. So you get culture right away.
And the food scene, beyond the usual suspects.
Oh, definitely evolving. The article highlights a new generation of chefs, including many women, who are doing really inventive things with traditional Anatolian ingredients.
Like yogurt, tahini, figs.
Exactly. It's a dynamic fusion. And experiencing the two continents is easy.
How so?
A 15-minute boat ride takes you from Europe to Asia to the Kajiko neighborhood.
What's that like?
Trendy, vibrant. Boutiques, antique shops, cafes, food markets, street art, parks along the coast. It's buzzing.
And cruising the Bosphorus itself.
A must-do, apparently. Past old imperial palaces, Ottoman mansions, described as a lifetime experience. It really captures that mix of history, in modern life.
But Istanbul's just the gateway, you said. Where else does Turkey beckon?
Oh, so many places. Let's talk regions. First, the Aegean olive routes.
Sounds picturesque.
It is.
Yeah.
Runs from Çanakkale down to Avalok. You're exploring ancient cities like Troy, Assos, places steeped in mythology, Paris, Helen, Aeneas.
Wow. Any specific highlights there?
Visiting the Gallipoli WWI Memorial is mentioned as quite poignant. And you can even dive among shipwrecks in the Gallipoli Historical Underwater Park.
Diving WWI wrecks, that's unique.
Definitely. Then there are the Turkish vineyards.
Wine? In Turkey?
Absolutely. It's a heritage going back thousands of years, and is having a real renaissance now.
What kind of grapes?
Unique indigenous ones. Brnova Muscati, Amir, Narents on the Aegean coast. Further east, more robust ones like Akuzguzu and Boraskir.
I'm not even going to try pronouncing those.
Chuckles.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But the highlight mentioned is the rise of farm-to-table restaurants, especially in Urla, pairing local wines with great food.
Okay, history, wine. What about that famous coastline?
All right, sailing through antiquity along the Aegean coast. This is about those luxurious journeys on traditional wooden yachts called gullets.
Gullets. Got it.
They let you reach secluded coves and ancient sites you often can't get to by land. Places like Halicarnassus, Knidos, the amazing rock-cut tunes of Kaunos.
Sounds incredible, like stepping back in time but in style.
Pretty much. Swimming in turquoise water, hiking ruins, dinner under the stars. It's that blend again. Then there's the Turkish Riviera.
Antalya region.
Yep. Famous for blue flag beaches, world-class golf in Belek, luxury hotels.
The resort side of things.
But also dramatic mountains, canyons, waterfalls, and of course, more ancient ruins. Nature and history side by side.
And that amazing claim about spring.
Oh yeah, that in a single day in spring, you could theoretically swim, then go ski at the Sakhalikin Ski Center, and then play golf at night.
Swim, ski, and golf in one day. That's versatile.
Yeah, it really showcases the variety.
Now, for those interested in a religious history, Turkey is significant, isn't it?
Hugely significant. It's home to the footsteps of the earliest Christians.
The seven churches of Revelation.
All located there along the western coast. In ruins like Pergamum, Ephesus, Smyrna. And a real standout is the Church of St. Peter in Antioch.
Why that one?
It's believed to be the world's first Christian church, carved right into a cave.
Wow. But you mentioned something even older, Göbekli Tepe.
Ah, yes, Göbekli Tepe, where it all began. This place is genuinely rewriting our understanding of early human civilization.
How old did you say?
12,000 years old. Located near Şanlıurfa, it's considered the world's first sanctuary, built by hunter-gatherers thousands of years before Stonehenge or the pyramids.
That's staggering. Hunter-gatherers built temples.
That's what the evidence suggests. Massive carved stone pillars. And recent discoveries nearby, at places called Taş Tepeler and Kerhantepe, hint at a whole network of these sites, a complex society we're only just beginning to understand.
Mind-blowing. And the food nearby?
Şanlıurfa and Gaziantep are mentioned as food capitals. Famous for local flavors, amazing kebabs.
History and food, a great combo. Okay, one more.
For the real adventurers, train travel in cars.
Out east?
Yeah, a remote journey on the Dozo Expressi, the Eastern Express. A 25-hour scenic train ride.
Sounds epic, especially in winter.
Apparently, that's when it's magical. Transforms the landscape. It was featured in Orhan Pamuk's novel Snow.
Ah, okay. And what's there?
You can visit Ani, a UNESCO site near the Armenian border. Used to be a major medieval city. Now hauntingly beautiful ruins of churches and fortresses. Or even skate on a frozen lake. Lake Şıldır, or ski nearby.
What an incredible range. Ancient sites, modern cities. Food, wine, adventure.
Turkey really does seem to offer something for almost everyone. It makes you see how a country can leverage both its deep history and modern appeal simultaneously.
Definitely makes you want to book a trip. Okay, let's shift from travel to something vital for well-being, health.
Right.
Newsweek, in partnership with Statista, released America's Best Physical Rehabilitation Centers 2025.
And this isn't just another list. It's a really crucial resource for people facing recovery.
Why so critical?
Because choosing the right rehab center can make a massive difference. The article points out that inpatient facilities, the ones ranked here, generally offer more intensive therapy.
Longer sessions, more specialists.
Exactly. And that seems to translate into better outcomes. Success rates are cited between 68 and 72%.
That's significantly higher than typical outpatient results, isn't it?
It suggests so. And crucially, these positive effects seem to last. 79% of patients reported substantial pain reduction after treatment.
So Quality rehab has a profound, lasting impact.
Absolutely. It affects recovery speed, long-term function, quality of life. Choosing the right place is a measurable factor in success.
Okay, so how did they put this ranking together? It's the sixth edition, you said?
Yes, sixth edition. They ranked 320 inpatient centers this year, up from 300 last year.
Covering the whole U.S.
Well, they focus on the 25 states with the most facilities. Others were grouped into four regions, Northeast, Midwest, West, South.
And the methodology. You mentioned it was robust.
Very. It's based on four distinct pillars, like a sturdy four-leg stool. Ensures objectivity and a comprehensive view.
Okay, break down those four legs for us.
Sure. The biggest leg, 55% of the score, is the quality metric score.
Based on hard data.
Exactly. From the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. It includes 15 different quality measures, standardized to allow fair comparisons.
Like infection rates, vaccination coverage.
Things like that. Patient safety, core care standards. The hard facts.
Got it. Pillar number two.
That's the reputation score, worth 30%.
How do they measure reputation?
Through a national online survey of experts conducted earlier this year. Thousands of physicians, therapists, clinic managers.
Yeah.
People in the field.
What do they ask them?
To recommend top centers in their state and rate them on quality of care, service, follow-up, even accommodation. They could also highlight standout programs like for amputations, brain injuries, stroke rehab.
So peer recognition is key. What's the third pillar?
Accreditation data, that's 10%.
From who?
Primarily the Commission on Accreditation of Rehabilitation Facilities, CARF. They're an independent nonprofit that audits and certifies quality standards. Getting their accreditation is a big deal.
And other accreditations, too.
Yeah, also designations from the Model Systems Knowledge Translation Center for specific injury types, spinal cord, traumatic brain injury, burns. It shows specialization.
Okay, quality metrics, reputation, accreditation. What's the last 5%?
Google reviews. Used as a proxy for patient satisfaction. Gives a direct voice to the patient experience.
Interesting. So it blends hard data, expert opinion, accreditation, and patient feedback.
Exactly. It's a multifaceted approach. Some notable names mentioned are Brooks Rehab, California Rehab Institute, Methodist Rehab, NYU Langone Rusk, Penn Medicine Lancaster Rehab.
The transparency of how they built the list is really helpful.
That's the goal, to give people reliable, data-driven information when they're making incredibly important, often vulnerable decisions.
Definitely valuable. Okay, let's transition now to another area of huge consequence, global security, and the often painful lessons learned from failure.
Right, a very different kind of critical assessment.
We're looking at a fatal sticking point, which is an excerpt from the book While Israel Slept by Yaakov Katz and Amir Bobot.
Mm-hmm.
And it digs into the lead up to the October 7th, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel.
Yeah, this is a powerful and frankly quite somber analysis. It's a stark case study in intelligence failures, misjudgments.
With catastrophic results.
Absolutely. It's a reminder of how dangerous assumptions can be, especially in national security. The book really tries to dissect how this massive failure happens.
The core insight being?
How a combination of sort of systemic biases, preconceptions, and specific miss signals just create this perfect storm.
Yeah.
A vulnerability that was tragically exploited.
So walk us through it. What happened in those crucial hours before the attack? Was it a total blind spot?
Not entirely blind. No, that's what's so chilling. There were signals, but they were missed, misinterpreted, or just didn't get escalated properly.
Like what?
Well, on Friday afternoon, October 6th, the IDF chief, Hirsi Halevi, held a meeting. The consensus? Nothing unusual expected for the holiday weekend. Maybe some minor smuggling attempt from Sinai into Gaza. Business as usual.
But underneath?
Problems were brewing. The commander of Unit 8200, that's Israel's top signals intelligence unit, like their NSA, found out a key Gaza monitoring system designed specifically to detect anomalies had crashed multiple times in the previous 24 hours.
Crash. Just bad luck.
Maybe. But the system was known to be flaky. However, some officials later suspected it wasn't random. Maybe a sophisticated cyber attack, maybe even deliberate power outages in Gaza to blind Israeli surveillance. A deliberate fog of war being created.
Okay, a potential system failure or sabotage. Were there human signals too? Direct intelligence.
Yes, and this is critical. Around 10 p.m. Friday night, the Shin Bet, that's their internal security agency, got a troubling alert.
What was it?
Dozens of senior Hamas operatives had activated mobile devices using Israeli SIM cards.
Why is that significant?
It was a known tactic. They used Israeli SIMs to try and evade detection while communicating, presumably during an operation, an incursion.
So a major red flag.
Should have been. The head of the Southern Command, Major General Finkelman, was alerted. He actually cut his vacation short and rushed back to headquarters.
So some alarm bells were ringing.
Yes, but here's where the interpretation went wrong. The SIM card activation was complicated. It was weird they stayed on. But similar, brief activations had happened before. Once, just the day before, October 5th, and another time exactly a year earlier, October 7th, 2022.
So they thought maybe it was just an annual test, a drill.
That became the assumption for many. But there was a key difference in 2023. It wasn't just a few SIMs in one spot. It was a much larger number, scattered all across Gaza. That crucial detail was somehow overlooked or downplayed.
And how did the top command react to this SIM card alert?
This is where a potentially fatal decision was made. IDF Chief Halabi ordered caution. He specifically told officers not to widely share the SIM card info, not to leave a digital trace. Basically, keep it quiet.
Why? To avoid tipping off Hamas?
Presumably. But the effect was it tied the hands of the Southern Command and the Gaza Division. They couldn't reinforce their positions along the border.
Hindsight is 20/20, of course, but...
But the book raises the question, what if they had? What if they'd moved a few more tanks to the border? Send up a couple more attack helicopters? Would that visible sign of Israeli awareness have been enough to deter Hamas? Make them call it off?
Impossible to know for sure, but it's a haunting question.
It really is. It highlights that tension between secrecy and deterrence. Then, around 2 a.m. Saturday morning,
October 7th,
the Shin Bet chief, Ronan Bar, got alerted to unclear preparation by Hamas, including activity around an underground tunnel complex.
Still thinking it might be a drill.
That was the initial thought. But Bar's gut instinct told him something was wrong. He went to headquarters. He feared a border crossing, kidnappings, even a wider escalation involving the West Bank, Hezbollah, Iran. His instincts were screaming danger.
But was this broader concern communicated effectively?
Apparently not effectively enough. And there was even more intelligence, a big surge in Hamas communications phone calls, messages doubling in the days leading up that reportedly got stuck within Amman, the military intelligence directorate.
Stuck? How?
Just didn't make it up the chain to Halevi or Finkelman in time. The system failed to connect the dots. So the clock ticked down, and Israel made no changes to its posture. The invasion began just a few hours later.
A catastrophic cascade of failures. What broader lessons does Yaakov Katz draw from this in the Q&A?
He points to several key factors. First, why Israel was unprepared. The core issue was this deeply ingrained assessment, this conceptia, that Hamas was deterred, that they weren't interested in a major conflict.
So they interpreted everything through that lens, confirmation bias.
Exactly. Any intelligence suggesting otherwise invasion plans, attack drills, was dismissed as probably just training, or maybe a very small-scale raid at worst. They couldn't conceive of what was actually coming.
What about the difference in how they viewed threats, like Hezbollah versus Hamas?
That's the second point, the discrepancy in preparedness. Israel had poured resources into preparing for Hezbollah on the northern border. That was seen as the primary, most dangerous threat.
Leading to things like that beeper attack in 2024, assassinations.
Yeah. Right. Proactive, aggressive measures. But Gaza, Katz argues, was different. They knew about the tunnels, but they never assessed Hamas as a strategic threat on the same level, one requiring the same kind of intense intelligence, focus, and follow-through.
So focusing heavily on one threat created a vulnerability elsewhere.
It seems that way. Then Katz makes a really sharp point about hostages as Israel's Achilles heel.
How so?
He argues Hamas understood Israel's extreme sensitivity to hostages brilliantly. The attack itself, killing 1,200 people, was horrific. But taking over 200 hostages, that, he says, continues to pierce the hearts of the Israelis every single day. It created immense emotional and political pressure, limiting Israel's operational freedom in a way the initial attack alone might not have. A calculated, tactical move.
That's a grim assessment of Hamas's strategy. Now, Katz makes a very provocative claim about the aftermath, this idea of re-engineering the Middle East.
Yes, this is probably the most controversial part. He argues that October 7, despite being an absolute disaster born from failure, paradoxically became a turning point.
A turning point how? He says Israel is safer now. That sounds counterintuitive given the ongoing conflict and instability.
It does sound counterintuitive, and he acknowledges the immense human cost. But his argument is specifically from a hard security and military perspective. He believes the shock of October 7 forced Israel, even the government responsible for the failures, to confront threats much more decisively than before.
So the actions taken since October 7th are what make Israel safer, in his view.
That's his argument. He points to the strikes against Iran's nuclear facilities, which he sees as a direct result of the heightened threat perception after October 7th, and the military actions that pushed Hezbollah back significantly from the northern border. From that strict security lens, comparing the immediate pre-October 7th situation to now, he argues the military balance against key adversaries has shifted in Israel's favor due to the actions taken in response to the attack. It's a specific security-focused claim, not a statement about overall peace or stability.
Understood. A very specific and likely debatable viewpoint. What about the U.S.-Israel relationship? It's often questioned domestically here.
Katz tackles that head-on. He argues the value of the U.S.-Israel partnership isn't a one-way street, challenging critics on both the left and right in the U.S.
How does he frame Israel's contribution?
He argues Israel provides critical value by directly confronting groups hostile to the U.S. Hezbollah, responsible for killing hundreds of U.S. Marines in Beirut. Iran, whose regime chanced death to America. Assad, Syria, which enabled al-Qaeda and ISIS to attack U.S. troops in Iraq. And Hamas itself, which killed and held American citizens.
He provides a concrete example regarding Syria recently.
Yes, he points out that when the Assad regime fell, al-Julani took over, Israel destroyed Syria's advanced military capabilities within 72 hours. His point is, this prevented those weapons' sophisticated air defenses, missiles, from falling into the hands of an al-Qaeda offshoot, making the region and potentially the world safer. He frames Israel's actions, like confronting Iran's nuclear program, as serving broader Western security interests, not just its own.
So looking ahead, how does Katz think October 7th will be remembered? Is there any optimistic view possible?
He offers a nuanced hope. He acknowledges it's currently seen as the greatest disaster in Israel's history, demanding accountability, but he hopes it might eventually be viewed as a crucial turning point.
Leading to positive changes.
Potentially.
Yeah.
Better border security, obviously, but maybe also new political possibilities. Relations with the new government in Lebanon after Hezbollah's setback. Normalization with the post-Assad Syria. Removing Hamas, freeing Palestinians from their rule, maybe even paving the way for Israel-Saudi normalization.
That sounds ambitious.
He admits it sounds hopeful, maybe even far-fetched now. But he believes with the right leadership, regionally and in Israel, it could create a whole new Middle East. It's a sobering analysis overall, highlighting intelligence failures, miscalculations, but also that potential for painful transformation that sometimes emerges from deep crisis. Definitely makes you think about consequences and how history gets reevaluated.
Absolutely. Okay, let's shift focus again from geopolitics to something closer to home for many personal finance, but through the lens of professional athletes.
Right. The Inspire section has this piece, Tackling the Money Problem.
Featuring NFL players Sheldon Day and Richard Sherman.
And it's tackling a really common but often hidden problem in pro sports, financial hardship after earning huge sums of money.
We hear about the massive contracts, right? T.J. Watt, Trey Smith getting $94 million, Sauce Gardner.
Exactly. Record-breaking deals. But the article points out a surprising number of athletes still end up bankrupt or struggling financially after they retire.
Why? Bad investments. Lavish spending.
Often a combination.
Yeah.
Questionable purchases, exotic pets, supercars, mansions, jewelry. We even hear stories of Super Bowl rings ending up in auctions. It shows earning it is one thing, keeping it and growing it is totally different.
So what's the root cause from an athlete's perspective? Sheldon Day shares his story.
Yeah, and it's really insightful. He came from, in his words, an impoverished area in Indianapolis. No financial literacy growing up.
His college was a shock.
Huge culture shock at Notre Dame. Seeing kids driving Aston Martins, Mercedes, wealth he'd never been exposed to. Then he gets drafted, signs his first NFL contract.
How much was it?
$2.9 million over 4 years, which sounds enormous.
Yeah.
He thought, I've made it, never have to work again.
Yeah.
But then reality hit.
Taxes. Expense.
Yeah. Taxes. Understanding things like FICO scores. Realizing how much gets taken away.
Yeah.
And then the pressure of the lifestyle.
What kind of pressure?
He talks about clubbing, seeing guys literally throw away $50,000 in cash. That pressure to keep up. Buy the diamond chains, the fancy cars.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you worked incredibly hard for that money.
And the insecurity of the job itself.
Crucial point. Seeing players get cut, careers ended by injury. It made him realize the NFL is a business. The money isn't guaranteed forever. That was his wake-up call to start saving and investing properly.
So clearly a massive need for guidance. That's where the players' company comes in.
Exactly. Founded by Day, Richard Sherman, who was famously savvy, negotiated his own deals, invested early in things like Bodyarmor, and a former NFL sports scientist, Tom Zhang.
And their mission?
Simple. help athletes achieve their full financial potential, provide resources to grow, manage, and sustain generational wealth.
Sherman was like a mentor today.
Yeah, Day calls him his business guru. Sherman shared his knowledge, inspired the idea to change the narrative surrounding athletes and their finances.
How do they approach the education part? It can be complex stuff.
Their key is making it relatable, translating complex financial ideas into terms athletes understand.
Like comparing spending to investing.
Precisely. They'll say, look, that $50,000 chain you want, what if you invested just $10,000 of that in a smart startup? That $10 could potentially become $1 million down the road, showing the opportunity cost, the power of smart choices for long-term security.
So they want to empower athletes to challenge the status quo in the financial industry, too.
Absolutely. Their ambition is to be the go-to company for athletes, where the athletes set the terms. They're challenging norms like financial managers charging fees, even when the athlete loses money.
Which happens.
Day says the industry has been so backward about that. He wants to stop athletes being prey to bad advice or predatory practices.
It sounds like it goes beyond just money management, too.
It does. They aim for a holistic approach, helping athletes build an identity outside of sports. To avoid that depression, that loss of identity that often hits after retirement, ensuring they can still add value to society after their playing days are over.
That's a really vital initiative, teaching financial literacy, empowerment, and looking at the whole person. Okay, let's switch to something lighter, but still about innovation and tradition sake.
Ah, Dasai sake, from mountain villages to outer space.
Right. The article is Dasai sake for future generations.
And this story is a fantastic example of how you can preserve cultural identity while embracing radical innovation.
Taking a traditional product global and even beyond.
Exactly. Dasai's journey is amazing. It started humbly back in 1948 in Yamaguchi Prefecture, just a modest brewery, Sahi Shuzo, making everyday tables safe.
And they were struggling.
By 1974, yeah. But then Hiroshi Sakurai, the third generation head, made a really bold move.
What did he do?
Expanded into the Tokyo market. But instead of competing on price or volume, he focused obsessively on quality. He challenged his brewery to make Junmai de Ginjo.
That's the super premium stuff, right? Highly polished rice.
Exactly. Minimum 50% polishing ratio. It results in that clean, aromatic flavor. They never made it before. He basically had to create a market for it through sheer persistence, trial, and error.
So quality was the gamble.
It was the core strategy. The current president, Kazuhiro Sakurai, says, "We embrace change and innovation because making delicious sake was essential for our survival." They completely shifted, now only making Junmai de Ginjo.
What makes theirs stand out?
Skillful brewing, obviously, but especially that precise rice polishing, removing the outer layers to get to the pure starch core. That's what gives their signature Dasai 23 its clean sweetness, its vibrant floral and fruity aroma. It's designed to be approachable, even for beginners.
Okay, so they mastered quality. How did that lead to global expansion? That seems like a big leap for a traditional brewery.
They were pioneers. 20 years ago, Dasai was one of the first small breweries to really push overseas, and they had to fight misconceptions.
Like sake being harsh, or only served hot, or only with sushi.
All of that. They actively worked to change perceptions, partnering with the Culinary Institute of America, for example. And then they built a brewery in New York.
A brewery in the U.S. Why?
To adapt. They realized New York's water, being more mineral-rich than the river water in Japan, would create a different sake. So instead of just replicating, they created Dasai Blue, an original sake designed for its environment. It shows real commitment to local adaptation.
Smart. And they partnered with a French chef, too.
Yeah, Yannick Alino. Opened a restaurant together in France, showcasing how sake can pair with global cuisine, not just Japanese. Elevating its status, integrating it into international food culture.
They're really pushing boundaries. Which brings us to sake in space. Seriously.
Chuckles.
Yeah.
Seriously. This is where the vision gets truly ambitious. In 2025, Dasai plans to become the first sake and probably the first alcoholic beverage ever brewed in microgravity.
Where? How?
Aboard the International Space Station. In Japan's Kibo module.
That's incredible. What's the project called?
Dasai Moon.
Fitting. What's the philosophy behind it?
It embodies their idea of carrying culture, traditions, social bonds into the future. The president literally envisions astronauts connecting with earthly tradition by sharing a cup of sake brewed in orbit, a symbol of humanity taking its heritage to new frontiers.
Wow. Talk about long-term vision.
He even hopes his son will inherit this mission, continuing to pursue growth without fear of trial and error. It's an amazing story of how innovation, even in a craft steeped in tradition, can be driven by this desire to preserve and expand cultural relevance, literally reaching for the stars.
From Yamaguchi Mountains to the ISS. Unbelievable. Okay, let's round things out with the culture section. First up, actress Grace Van Patten.
Right, talking about her role in that Hulu series, The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox.
A very high-profile, controversial case.
Extremely. And this piece offers a look at that intersection of media, public perception, and the elusive nature of truth, especially when a story gets so sensationalized.
How did Van Patten approach playing Amanda Knox?
She felt grateful for the chance, seeing it as an opportunity for Knox herself to reclaim her own narrative, or at least offer her perspective.
Her acting strategy.
She said she leaned into the confusion surrounding the case.
Hmm.
Found it more truthful to just be present in those uncertain moments rather than playing a definitive guilty or innocent version.
What did she learn from the experience?
A lot about how easily people, especially women, she noted, can be scrutinized and villainized in the press, often driven by the financial incentive of shock value that sells stories. She hopes the series might help shift some long-held opinions.
Did she work with Amanda Knox directly?
Yes, and she said that was crucial. Knox was the most useful thing for her preparation. They had open communication.
That must have been intense, but valuable.
Van Patten said it fueled her passion to portray Knox authentically, to try and correct what she felt were incorrect public views shaped by years of media coverage.
How does this show aim to be different from typical true crime?
The aim for sensitivity and a clear perspective, focusing more on understanding the people involved and what happened, rather than just exploiting the morbid details for shock value.
And Knox's experience of isolation?
Van Patten highlights that. The language barrier, being kept in the dark about how she was being portrayed globally, meaning Knox was often just being herself, completely unaware she was being judged and villainized by millions. It's a chilling thought.
A powerful reminder about narrative control and media responsibility. Okay, finally, let's talk about Chad Michael Murray.
From teen heartthrob to, well, still acting, but reflecting.
Yeah, the parting shot features him discussing his return to the Freaky Friday franchise.
Freakier Friday, they called it.
Right, and reflecting on his own journey through fame.
It's quite a candid reflection, actually. Navigating that intense early fame, dealing with challenges, finding new priorities.
How did he feel about returning to Freaky Friday after, what, 20 years?
Pure joy, he said. He even joked it might be better than the first, and quipped it would make you live longer, lower your cholesterol.
Chuckles. Still got the charm. How did he update his character, Jake?
He went into analytics mode, apparently. Imagining Jake now owning multiple businesses, having lots of cars, maybe even a shrine to Lindsay Lohan's character, just having fun with it.
And working with Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan again.
Like reuniting with old friends, he said. No time has passed.
Mm.
Described it as a love fest. On set.
That sounds nice, but he also touches on the tougher side of his early career.
Yeah, he's pretty open about the rough years after he shot to fame on shows like One Tree Hill and Gilmore Girls. Called it an unhealthy environment.
The pressure of being a teen idol.
Intense pressure, scrutiny. His advice now to his younger self, let go. Remember why you started acting in the first place. Find the joy in the work itself.
Has becoming a father changed his perspective on roles?
Massively. He says fatherhood changed everything.
How so?
He prefers light roles now, comedy. He explicitly said something like a dark, intense show like Euphoria wouldn't work for him anymore.
Why not?
Because he'd rather be at home, changing a dirty diaper or playing catch in the yard. His priorities have clearly shifted.
It's refreshing to hear that kind of honesty about the journey. From idol to family man, shows how life changes you.
Absolutely. Emphasizes that shift in priorities that often comes with age and experience. Authenticity matters.
Okay, before we wrap this deep dive, let's quickly hit some highlights from the In Focus section and a few interesting ads.
Right, those quick snapshots that add texture to the week's news.
First, the In Focus photos. Anything stand out?
A few compelling ones. In Kiruna, Sweden, that picture, Holy Rollers.
Moving the entire church.
Yeah, 700-ton historic church moved 3 miles because an iron ore mine is expanding underneath it. An incredible feat of engineering, but also highlights that tension between heritage and economic necessity.
Definitely. What else?
In New Delhi, Birth Colors showed an artist finishing a Ganesha idol for the Ganesh Chaturthi Festival. A beautiful image capturing cultural tradition, religious art, and the role of migrant artisans. In Alexandria, Egypt, From the Deep.
Divers and Artifacts.
Yeah, watching a crane lift relics recovered from Abu Kir Bay. part of an exhibition of 86 salvaged pieces from the seabed, a glimpse into ancient history literally rising from the depths.
Amazing. And politics.
A shot from Washington, D.C., talking about peace, showed President Zelensky, President Trump, and European leaders at the White House discussing the Ukraine conflict within that coalition of the willing, underscoring ongoing diplomacy, alliances, the complexities of global leadership.
Okay, and briefly, any innovations or ads catch your eye?
A few interesting ones. M.G. Schefftal's Ember series of historical books got praise for meticulous novelistic recreations. Reminds you of the power of good historical storytelling.
Any tech or industry stuff?
The French oil mill machinery company was highlighted, an American company making hydraulic presses since 1900, crucial for things like rubber and composite parts in cars, defense, medical devices, foundational tech we don't often think about.
E-commerce logistics.
Smart cargo. Airline tech connecting e-commerce demand with airline cargo space. Desktop-to-doorstep solutions, super relevant in today's economy.
And infrastructure.
Aurigo Masterworks Cloud, software for managing huge capital projects, like the trillions the U.S. government is spending on infrastructure, helping to build smarter, points to the future of managing massive public works efficiently.
So even the smaller pieces add layers to the picture.
Absolutely. Challenges, ingenuity, global connections, it's all there.
All right, and just like that, our deep dive into Newsweek USA for the week of September 5th to 12th, 2025 comes to a close.
We covered a lot of ground.
We really did. From the NFL's global game plan and Terry Bradshaw's beans.
Chuckles. To vital rehab rankings, sobering intelligence lessons, sake in space.
Financial literacy for athletes, actors reflecting on fame. It was packed.
It paints a picture, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
A world constantly shifting, balancing tradition and innovation, facing challenges, finding new ways to connect.
And the role of leadership seemed to pop up again and again in sports, business, global affairs, shaping outcomes, shaping narrative.
For better or worse, yeah.
Yeah.
And individual stories reflecting those broader shifts.
So for you, the listener, what's the takeaway? Maybe it's seeing how interconnected everything is, how global trends affect sports, how technology affects tradition.
Or maybe it's understanding the detailed work behind something like a healthcare ranking.
Yeah.
Or the human lessons from history, even recent history, the personal journeys. Maybe they resonate with your own challenges.
Financial planning, navigating public perception, changing priorities.
Yeah. So here's a final thought to chew on, building on all this. We see examples here of people turning challenges into opportunities, data points into new strategies, whether it's aiming for a whole new Middle East after a crisis or turning sake into a drink for space travelers.
Right.
So the question for you is, in this complex world, how can you cultivate that same blend of critical thinking, adaptability, open-mindedness? What overlooked data points in your own life, your work, your community might hold the key to unexpected growth or innovation if you just connect the dots differently?
What overlooked data points? That's a great question to ponder, a perfect place to leave it. Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive.
We hope you feel informed, maybe even a little inspired.
Inspired to look closer at the world around you. Until next time, keep digging.